Then he bade her a pleasant evening, and, smiling as though nothing unusual had occurred that afternoon, climbed out. When she saw him last, it was in the rear-view mirror, speeding in the opposite direction, atop a small motorcycle. Fleeing the scene of a crime, she thought. Olivia continued eastward along the rim of the bay, and a few minutes later entered the luxurious villa she shared with the man whom she had just betrayed. In the kitchen, she poured herself a large glass of rosé and carried it outside onto the terrace. Through the sharp glare of the setting sun, she could make out the faint outlines of Monsieur Antonov's monstrous villa. Presently her mobile phone trembled. She stared at the screen. "Home in 5. What's the surprise?" "The surprise," she said aloud, "is that your Russian friend and his bitch of a wife just wrote me a check for 50 million euros. She said it again and again, until even she believed it was true. Chapter 35. Marseille, France. At 11:45 the following morning, the sum of 50 million euros appeared in the account of Galerie Olivia Watson, 9, Place de l'Ormeau, Saint-Tropez, France. The money did not have to travel far, as both sender and recipient did their banking at HSBC on the Boulevard Haussmann in Paris. By mid-afternoon it was resting comfortably in a renowned Swiss bank in Geneva, in an account controlled by JLM Enterprises. And at 5 o'clock, two paintings, one by Gustin, the other by Basquiat, were delivered by unmarked van to Villa Soleil. Olivia Watson followed in her black Range Rover. In the entrance hall she passed Christopher Keller, who was on his way out. He kissed her lavishly on both cheeks, commented on her appearance, which was dazzling, and then climbed onto his Peugeot Satellis motorbike. A moment later he was racing westward along the shore of the Mediterranean. It was nearly dusk by the time he reached the outskirts of Marseille. The violent drug gangs thrived in the city's northern banlieues, especially in the housing projects of Bassens and Paternel, but Keller approached through the more tranquil suburbs to the east. The tunnel Prado-Carénage delivered him to the old port, and from there he made his way to the Rue Grignon. Slender and straight as a ruler, it was lined with the likes of Boss, Vuitton, and Armani. There was even a JLM jewelry boutique. Keller saw he could detect the sour odor of hashish as he passed. As he continued across the city center, into the quartier of Marseille known as La Camaz, the streets turned dirty and mean, and the shops and cafés catered to a decidedly immigrant and working-class clientele. One such enterprise, located on the ground floor of a graffiti-splattered building overlooking the Place Jean Jaurès, peddled discount electronic goods and mobile phones to a largely Moroccan and Algerian customer base. Its proprietor, however, was a Frenchman named René Devereaux. Devereaux owned a number of other small businesses in Marseille, all of which were cash-oriented, some in the category loosely defined as adult entertainment, but the electronics shop served as something like his operational headquarters. His office was on the second floor of the building. The room contained no telephone or electronic devices of any kind, a curious set of circumstances for a man who purportedly sold such modern conveniences for a living. René Devereaux didn't care much for the telephone, and was said that he had never once personally sent an email or text message. He communicated with his business associates and subordinates only in person, oftentimes in the gritty square or at a street-side table at Au Petit Nice, a reasonably pleasant café located a few paces from his shop. Keller knew all this because René Devereaux was a prominent figure in the world he had once inhabited. Everyone in the French criminal underground knew that Devereaux's real business was drug trafficking. Not just street-level trafficking, but trafficking on a continent-wide scale. The French police were likely aware of it too, but Devereaux, unlike many of his competitors, had never spent a single day behind bars. He was a made man, and untouchable. Until tonight, thought Keller. For it was René Devereaux's name that Olivia Watson had spoken in the safe house outside Ramatuelle. Devereaux was the one who made the trains run on time, the one who moved the hashish from the docks of southern Europe to the streets of Paris and Amsterdam and Brussels. The one, thought Keller, who knew all of Jean-Luc Martel's secrets. They would have only one chance to get him cleanly. Fortunately, they had at their disposal some of the best field operatives in the business. Keller left the motorbike at the edge of the Place Jean Jaurès and walked to Devereux's shop. Peering at the merchandise in the cluttered display window, he saw two men, both French in appearance, observing him from their outpost behind the counter. On the second floor, light burned behind the shuttered French door that gave onto the crumbling balcony. Keller turned away and continued along the street for about 50 meters before stopping next to a parked van. Giancomo, Don Orsatti's errand boy, sat behind the wheel. Two other Orsatti operatives were crouched in the rear cargo compartment, smoking nervously. Giancomo, however, appeared outwardly calm. Keller suspected it was for his benefit.
When was the last time you saw him?
About 20 minutes ago, he stepped onto the balcony to have a cigarette.
Are you sure he's still in there?
We have a man watching the back of the building.
Where are the others?
The young Corsican nodded toward the Place Jean Jaurès. The square was crowded with residents of the quartier, many in the traditional clothing of Africa or the Arab world. Even Keller couldn't swap the Don's men. He looked at Giancomo. No mistakes, do you hear me? Otherwise you're liable to start a war, and you know how the Don feels about wars.
Wars are good for the Don's business.
Not when he's a combatant.
Don't worry, I'm not a little boy anymore. Besides, I have this.
Giancomo tugged at the talisman around his neck. It was identical to Keller's.
She sends her best, by the way.
Did she say anything else?
Something about a woman.
What about her?
Giancomo shrugged. You know how the signora is. She talks in riddles.
Keller smoked a cigarette while walking to Au Petit Nice. Inside it was bedlam. Marseille was playing Lyon, but there were a few tables to be had outside in the street. At one sat a man of medium build, with dense silvery hair and thick black spectacles. At an adjacent table, two dark-eyed men in their 20s were watching the pedestrians moving along the pavements with unusual intensity. Keller walked over to the silver-haired man and, uninvited, sat down. There was a bottle of pastis and a single glass. Keller signaled the waiter and requested a second.
You know, he said in French, you really should drink some.
It tastes like licorice-flavored gasoline, replied Gabriel.
He watched two robed men walking arm in arm in the street.
I can't believe we're back here again.
Au Petit Nice.
Marseille, said Gabriel.
It was inevitable. When one is attempting to penetrate a European drug network, all roads lead to Marseille.
Keller watched the pedestrians, too.
Do you suppose Rousseau was true to his word?
Why wouldn't he be?
Because he's a spy, which means he lies as a matter of course.
You're a spy, too.
But not long ago I was employed by Don Anton Orsatti, the same Anton Orsatti, added Keller, who's about to help us with a little dirty work tonight. And if Rousseau and his friends from Alpha Group happen to be watching, it will place the Don, peace be upon him, in a rather ticklish position.
Rousseau wants nothing to do with what's about to happen here. As for the Don, Gabriel went on, helping us with this little piece of dirty work, as you so callously refer to it, is the best decision he's made since hiring you.
How so?
Because after tonight, no one will be able to lay a finger on him. He'll be immune.
You think like a criminal.
One has to in our line of work.
The waiter delivered the second glass. Keller filled it with pastis while Gabriel consulted his mobile phone.
Any problems?
Madame Sophie and Monsieur Antonov are quarreling over where to hang the new paintings.
And they were doing so well.
Yes, said Gabriel vaguely as he returned the phone to his jacket pocket.
Think they're going to make it?
I have my doubts.
Keller drank some of the pastis.
So what do you intend to do with all those paintings when the operation is over?
I have a feeling Monsieur Antonov will discover his Jewish roots and make a rather high-profile donation to the Israel Museum.
And the 50 million euros you gave to Olivia?
I didn't give her anything. I purchased 2 paintings from her gallery.
That, said Keller, is a distinction without a difference.
It's a rather small price to pay if it leads us to Saladin.
If, said Keller.
Is it my imagination, said Gabriel, or is there something between you and—
It's your imagination.
She's a very pretty girl, and when this is all over, she's going to be quite well off.
I try to stay away from girls who latch onto rich French drug dealers.
Are you forgetting what you used to do for a living?
Frowning, Keller drank more of the pastis.
So Monsieur Antonov is Jewish?
Apparently so.
I would have never guessed.
Gabriel shrugged indifferently.
I'm a little Jewish.
Did I ever mention that?
You might have.
A silence fell between them. Gabriel stared morosely into the street.
I can't believe we're back here again.
It won't be much longer.
Keller watched two men climb from the back of the van and enter the electronics shop owned by René Devereaux. Then he glanced at his watch. About 5 minutes. Maybe less.
From their exterior table at Au Petit Nice, Keller and Gabriel had only an obstructed view of what came next. A few seconds after the two men entered the shop, several flashes of light spilled from the display window into the street. They were faint, in fact they might have been mistaken for the flicker of a television, and there was no sound at all, at least none that reached the noisy café. After that, the shop went entirely dark, with the exception of a small neon sign in the door that read, Fermé. Pedestrians flowed past along the pavement as though nothing were out of the ordinary. Keller's eyes returned to the van where Giacomo was removing a large rectangular cardboard box from the rear compartment. It was an oddly shaped box, manufactured to Don Orsatti's exacting standards by a paper products factory on Corsica. It was quite obviously empty, for Giacomo had no trouble conveying it across the street and through the front door of the shop. But a few minutes later, when the box reappeared, it was borne by the two men who had entered the shop first, with Giacomo holding one side like a pallbearer. The two men inserted the box into the back of the van and crawled in after it while Giacomo reclaimed his place behind the wheel. Then the van slid away from the curb, rounded the corner, and was gone. From inside Au Petit Nice, there arose a loud cheer. Marseille had scored a goal against Lyon.
Not bad, said Gabriel.
Keller checked the time. 4 minutes, 12 seconds.
Unacceptable by office standards, but more than adequate for tonight.
You sure you don't want to join in the fun?
I've had enough to last a lifetime.
But do send the Don my best, said Gabriel, and tell him the check is in the mail.
With that, Keller departed. A moment later, straddling the Peugeot Satellis, he flashed past Au Petit Nice, where a man with dense silver hair and thick black spectacles sat alone, wondering how long it would be before Jean-Luc Martel discovered that the chief of his illicit narcotics division was missing.
Chapter 36 The Mediterranean Sea. Celine was a Baia Atlantica 78. With three cabins, an MTV diesel engine capable of producing speeds of 54 knots, and a long, slender prow that could accommodate a small helicopter. Keller, however, reached the vessel by less conspicuous means, namely a Zodiac dinghy that had been left for him at an isolated marina in the Rhone estuary near the town of Saint-Marie-de-la-Mer. He tied the craft to the aft swim platform and climbed up to the main salon, where he found Don Orsatti watching the Marseille-Lyon match on the satellite television. Dressed as he was now, in his simple Corsican clothing and dusty sandals, he looked distinctly out of place amid the luxurious leather and wood fittings. Giacomo was on the bridge with the pilot.
"Marseille scored again," said the Don, disconsolate.
He pointed the remote at the screen and it turned to black. Keller looked around the interior of the salon.
I expected something a bit more modest.
I'm too old to be moving around the Mediterranean in the belly of a fishing trawler. Besides, you'll be glad to have 24 meters of boat beneath you later tonight. It's supposed to blow.
Who does it belong to?
A friend of a friend.
And the pilot? Asked Keller with a glance toward the bridge.
He's mine.
Keller looked down and for the first time noticed several drops of drying blood.
He had a gun on the desk when they went in, explained the Don. He took one in the shoulder.
Is he going to live?
I'm afraid so.
Has he seen your face?
Not yet.
Did you bring a hammer?
A nice one, said the Don.
Where's Devereaux?
In the single, I didn't want him to make a mess in one of the masters.
Keller looked at the floor again.
Someone really should clean this up. Not me, said the Don. I can't stand the sight of blood.
One of the Don's men was standing watch outside the door of the single. There was no sound from within.
Is he conscious? Asked Keller.
See for yourself.
Keller went in and closed the door behind him. The room was in darkness. It smelled of sweat and fear and faintly of blood. He switched on the built-in reading lamp and aimed the cone of light toward the figure stretched motionless upon the twin bed. Silver duct tape obscured the eyes and mouth. The hands were bound and secured to the torso. The legs and ankles were trussed. Keller scrutinized the wound to the right shoulder. There had been a substantial amount of blood loss, but for now the flow had stopped. Even so, the bedding was drenched. The friend of a friend, thought Keller, would need a new mattress when this was over. He tore the duct tape from the eyes. René Devereaux blinked rapidly several times. Then, when Keller leaned into the light, showing Devereaux his face, the drug trafficker recoiled in fear. It seemed their acquaintance was mutual.
Bonsoir, René. Thanks for dropping by. How's the shoulder?
The eyes narrowed. The fear evaporated. Devereaux was trying to send the Englishman from Corsica a message that he was not a man to be shot, kidnapped, and bound like a game bird. Keller removed the duct tape from Devereaux's mouth, thus allowing him to give voice to such sentiments.
You're a dead man. You and that fat Corsican you work for.
Are you referring to Don Orsatti?
Fuck Don Orsatti.
Those are three very unwise words. I wonder whether you would dare to say them to the Don's face.
I would shit on the Don and the rest of his family.
Would you indeed? Keller went out. To the Corsican standing outside the door, he said, Ask His Holiness to come down for a minute.
He's watching the match. I'm sure he'll be able to tear himself away, said Keller. And bring me the hammer.
The Corsican went up the companionway, and a moment later, with some difficulty, Don Orsatti came down. Keller ushered him into the cabin and displayed him for René Devereaux to see. The Don smiled at Devereaux's obvious discomfort.
Monsieur Devereaux has something he wishes to tell you, said Keller. Go ahead, René. Please tell Don Orsatti what you said to me a moment ago.
Greeted by silence, Keller showed the Don out. Then he stood menacingly over the captive drug trafficker. Suffice it to say you have a narrow window of opportunity.
You can tell me what I want to know, or I can explain to the Don all the naughty things you said about him and his beloved family. And then...
Keller held up his hands to indicate the uncertainty of Devereaux's fate under such an emotionally charged scenario.
"Since when have you been in the information business?" asked Devereaux.
"Since I made a career change. I'm working for British intelligence now. Haven't you heard, René?"
"You? A British spy? I don't believe it."
"Sometimes I don't believe it either. But it happens to be true.
And you're going to help me. You're going to be a confidential source. And I'm going to be your control officer." "You can't be serious."
"Consider your current circumstances. They are as serious as it gets. So is our mission. You're going to help me find the man who's been orchestrating all the terrorist attacks here in Europe and in America."
"How am I going to do that? I'm a drug dealer, for God's sake."
"I'm glad we cleared that up. But you're no ordinary drug dealer, are you? Dealer is too small a word for what you do. You run an entire global network from that dump on the Place Jean Jaurès."
"And you do it," said Keller, "for Jean-Luc Martel."
"Who?" asked Devereaux.
"Jean-Luc Martel. The one with all the restaurants, and the hotels, and the hair." "And the pretty English girlfriend," said Devereaux.
"So you do know him?"
"Sure. I used to go to his first restaurant in Marseille. He was a nobody then. Now he's a big star."
"Because of drugs," said Keller.
"Hashish, to be specific. Hashish that comes from Morocco. Hashish that you distribute throughout Europe. Martel's empire would collapse if it wasn't for the hashish, but you would never dream of cutting him out.
because that would mean finding a new method of laundering $5 or $10 billion a year in drug profits. Your so-called legitimate businesses might be enough to make you look reasonably respectable to the French tax authorities, but there's no way they could handle all the profits from a global narcotics network. By that, you need a real business conglomerate, a conglomerate that takes in hundreds of millions of dollars a year in cash receipts. A conglomerate that acquires and develops large tracts of real estate. And buys and sells paintings.
After a silence, Devereaux added,
I knew she was trouble the first time I met her.
Who?
That English bitch.
Keller balled his right hand into a fist and drove it with all his strength into Devereaux's blood-soaked shoulder.
But back to the matter at hand, he said, while the Frenchman writhed on the bed in agony. You're going to tell me everything you know about Jean-Luc Martel, the names of your suppliers in Morocco, the routes by which you bring the drugs into Europe, the methods you use for inserting the money into the financial bloodstream of JLM Enterprises.
All of it, René.
And if I do?
We're going to make a video, said Keller.
And if I don't?
You're going to get the JLM treatment.
And I'm not talking about a nice dinner or a night in a luxury hotel suite.
Devereaux managed a smile. Then from deep within his throat, he produced a rich, gelatinous ball of phlegm and spat it into Keller's face. With a corner of the bedding, Keller calmly wiped away the mess before going out to retrieve the hammer from the Corsican. He struck Devereaux with it several times, concentrating his efforts on the right shoulder and avoiding the head and face entirely. Then he went up to the companionway to the main salon, where he found Don Rossati watching the football match.
Was it something he said or didn't say?
It was something he did, answered Keller.
Was there blood?
A little.
I'm glad you waited until I left. I can't stand the sight of blood.
A thunderous cheer spilled from the television.
It's a rout, said the Don gloomily.
Yes, answered Keller. Let us hope.
Chapter 37 The Mediterranean Sea. Christopher Keller made three more trips to the smallest of Celine's cabins, one at 11, a second shortly after midnight, and a lengthy visit beginning at 1:30 that left René Devereaux, a hardened Marseille criminal with much blood on his hands, weeping uncontrollably and begging for mercy. Keller bestowed it, but only on one condition. Devereaux was going to tell him everything on camera. Otherwise, Keller was going to break every bone in Devereaux's body. Slowly, with care and forethought, and pauses for refreshment and reflection. He had made a great deal of progress toward that eventuality already. Devereaux's right shoulder, in which a bullet was lodged, had suffered numerous fractures. Additionally, the right elbow was fractured, as was the left. Both hands were in deplorable condition, and the injury to the right knee, were it allowed to heal properly, would likely have left Devereaux with a permanent limp to match Saladin's. Moving him to the salon, where a camera had been mounted atop a tripod, proved to be a challenge. Giancomo pulled him up the companionway while Keller pushed from beneath, giving much-needed support to the ruined leg. Cognac was provided, along with a powerful over-the-counter French pain medication that could make one forget a missing limb. Keller helped Devereaux into a bright yellow watch jacket, and with a comb tidied up his lank, thinning hair. Then he switched on the camera and, after scrutinizing the shot carefully, posed his first question.
What is your name?
René Devereaux.
What do you do for a living?
I own an electronics shop on the Place Jean Jaurès. What is the real nature of your work? Drugs. Where did you first meet Jean-Luc Martel? At a restaurant in Marseille. Who owned the restaurant? Philippe Renard. What was Renard's real business? Drugs. Where is Philippe Renard now? Dead. Who killed him? Jean-Luc Martel. How did he kill him? With a hammer. What does Jean-Luc Martel do now? He owns several restaurants, hotels, and retail businesses. What is his real business? Drugs, said René
Devereux.
They put in at Ayacu at 9:30. From there it was only a pleasant walk around the curving shoreline of the gulf to the airport. The next flight for Marseille departed at noon. Keller arrived at 11:15, having stopped for a late breakfast and to purchase a change of clothing. He dressed in an airport washroom and then cleared security with no possessions other than his wallet, a British passport, and his MI6 mobile. On it was a compressed and heavily encrypted video of René Devereux's interrogation. At that moment, it was perhaps the most important single piece of intelligence in the global war on terrorism. Keller switched off the phone before takeoff and did not turn it on again until he was walking through the terminal in Marseille. Mikhail was waiting outside, in the back of Dmitry Antonov's Maybach. Yakov Rossman was behind the wheel. They listened to the interrogation through the car's magnificent sound system while heading eastward on the autoroute.
"You missed your true calling," said Mikhail. "You should have been a television interviewer, or a grand inquisitor."
"Repent, my son."
"Think he will?"
"Martel, not without a fight."
"There's no way he can hide from this video. He's ours now."
"We'll see," said Keller.
Because it was high summer, the traffic into Saint-Tropez was a nightmare, and it was approaching 4 p.m. by the time the Maybach turned through the gate of the safe house in Ramatuel. Entering, Keller transferred the video file into the main operational computer network. A moment later, René Devereux's face appeared on the monitors.
"Where is Philippe Reynard now?"
"Dead."
"Who killed him?"
"Jean-Luc Martel."
"How did he kill him?"
"With a hammer."
And on it went for the better part of 2 hours. Names, dates, places, routes, methods, money. It all came down to money. Under Keller's relentless questioning, and the threat unseen on the video of the hammer, René Devereux surrendered the network's most precious secrets. How the money was collected from the street-level dealers, how the money was loaded into the laundry that was JLM Enterprises, and how, once it was cleaned and pressed, it was dispersed. The detail was granular, high resolution. There was no hiding from it. Jean-Luc Martel was in their sights. But who would be the one to offer a lifeline? Paul Rousseau declared it would be him. Martel, he said, was a French problem. Only a French solution would do. And so, with Gabriel's help, Rousseau prepared an edited clip of the interrogation, 33 seconds in length. It was a teaser, an appetizer. A love tap, as Gabriel called it. Martel was holding court in the bar of his restaurant in the Old Port when it appeared on his phone via an anonymous text. The phone itself was thoroughly compromised, allowing Gabriel and Rousseau and the rest of the team to watch the many shades of Martel's rising alarm as he viewed it. A second video appeared a few seconds later, just for good measure. It depicted a brief sexual encounter between Martel and Monique, Olivia's receptionist at the gallery. It had been shot with the same phone Martel now held in his hand, which, from the team's unique perspective, appeared to be shaking uncontrollably. It was at this point that Rousseau dialed Martel directly. Not surprisingly, he did not answer, leaving Rousseau no option but to offer his terms in a voice message. They were the equivalent of unconditional surrender. Jean-Luc Martel was to present himself forthwith at Villa Soleil alone, with no bodyguards. Any attempt to escape, warned Rousseau, would be thwarted. His planes and helicopters would be grounded. His 142-foot motor yacht would be stranded in port. "Obviously," said Rousseau, "your movements and communications are being monitored. You have one opportunity to avoid arrest and ruin. I'd advise you to take it." With that, Rousseau terminated the call. 5 minutes elapsed before Martel listened to the message, at which point the wait began. Gabriel stood before the monitors, a hand to his chin, his head tilted slightly to one side, while in the garden Christopher Keller smashed his MI6 phone to bits with a hammer. Rousseau watched from the French doors. He would give Martel one chance to save himself. He only hoped he was wise enough to take it. Chapter 38. Côte d'Azur, France. This time they left the gate open for him, though at Gabriel's suggestion
they blocked the road beyond Villa Sole, lest he have a change of heart and try to make a run for it westward along the Côte d'Azur. He arrived alone at 9:15 that same night, after a series of tense phone calls with Paul Rousseau. His appearance at the villa, he claimed, was by no means an admission of anything. He did not know the man in the video. His claims were ludicrous. His business was hospitality and luxury retail, not drugs, and anyone who claimed otherwise would face serious legal consequences. In response, Rousseau made it clear that this was not a legal question, but a matter involving French national security. Martel, during a final tense exchange, actually sounded intrigued. He demanded to bring a lawyer. "No lawyers," said Rousseau. "They only get in the way." Once again it was Roland Girard of Alpha Group who awaited him in the forecourt. His greeting was decidedly less cordial. "Are you carrying a weapon?"
"Don't be ridiculous."
"Raise your arms." Reluctantly, Martel complied. Girard searched him thoroughly, beginning with the back of the neck and ending with the ankles. Rising, the Alpha Group operative found himself staring into a pair of furious dark eyes.
"Is there something you wish to say to me, Jean-Luc?"
Martel was silent at first.
"This way," said Girard.
He took Martel by the elbow and led him into the villa. Christopher Keller waited in the entrance hall.
"Jean-Luc, so sorry about the circumstances of the invitation, but we needed to get your attention."
They were the last French words Keller spoke. The rest flowed in British-accented English.
"Lives are at stake, you see, and we haven't much time. This way, please."
Martel remained frozen in place.
"Something wrong, Jean-Luc?"
"You're
not French,"
interjected Keller. "And I'm not from the island of Corsica, either. All that was for your benefit.
I'm afraid you've been the target of a rather elaborate deception."
Dazed, Martel followed Keller into the grandest of Villa Soleil's sitting rooms, where long white curtains billowed and snapped like mainsails in the night wind. Natalie sat at one end of a couch, dressed in a tracksuit and her neon green trainers. Mikhail sat opposite in a pair of jeans and a V-neck cotton pullover. Paul Rousseau was scrutinizing one of the paintings. And, in the far corner of the room, alone on his own private island, Gabriel was scrutinizing Jean-Luc Martel. It was Rousseau, turning, who spoke next.
"I wish we could say it is a pleasure to meet you, but it is not. When we look at you, we wonder why it is we do what we do, why we make the sacrifices, why we take the risks. Quite honestly, your life is not worth protecting. But that's neither here nor there. We need your help. And so we have no choice but to welcome you, however grudgingly, into our midst."
Martel's eyes moved from face to face. The man he knew as Monsieur Carnot, the Antonovs, the silent figure watching him from his lonely outpost in the corner of the room, before settling once more on Rousseau.
"Who are you?"
he asked.
"My name," replied Rousseau, "is not important. Indeed, in our line of work, names don't really mean much, as I'm sure you realize by now."
"Who do you work for?"
"A Department of the Interior Ministry."
"The DGSI?"
"It's not relevant. In fact," Rousseau added, "the only salient aspect of my employment is that I'm not a police officer."
"And the rest?"
asked Martel, glancing around the room.
"They are associates of mine."
He looked at Gabriel.
"What about him?"
"Think of him as an observer."
Martel frowned.
"Why am I here? What is this about?"
"Drugs," answered Rousseau.
"I told you I'm not involved in drugs."
Rousseau exhaled slowly.
"Let's skip this part, shall we? You know what you do for a living, and so do we. In a perfect world, you would be in handcuffs right now, but needless to say, this world of ours is far from perfect. It's a chaotic, dangerous mess. But your work," said Rousseau disdainfully, "has left you uniquely positioned to do something about it. We're prepared to be generous if you help us, and equally unforgiving if you refuse."
Martel squared his shoulders and stood a little taller.
"That video," he said, "proves nothing."
"You've only heard a small portion of it. The entire video is nearly 2 hours in length, and quite extraordinary in detail. In short, it lays bare all your dirty secrets.
Were such a document to fall into the hands of the police, you would certainly spend your remaining years behind bars. Which is where, Rousseau added pointedly, you belong. And if the tape were given to an enterprising reporter, who's never bought into the JLM fairy tale, the impact on your business empire would be catastrophic. All your powerful friends, the ones you bribe with food and drink and luxury accommodations, would abandon you like rats fleeing a sinking ship. No one would protect you. Martel opened his mouth to answer, but Rousseau plowed on. And then there is the matter of Galerie Olivia Watson. We've had the opportunity to review several of its transactions. They're questionable, to say the least. Especially those 48 blank canvases that were shipped to the Geneva Freeport. You've placed Madame Watson in an untenable situation. Her art gallery, like the rest of your empire, is a criminal enterprise. Oh, I suppose it's possible you might wriggle out of the noose, but your wife...
She's not my wife.
Oh, yes, forgive me, said Rousseau. How should I refer to her? Martel ignored the question.
Have you involved her in this?
Madame Watson knows nothing, and we would prefer to keep it that way. There's no need to drag her into this. At least, not yet. Rousseau paused, then asked, How did you explain the fact that you were coming here tonight?
I told her I had a business meeting.
And she believed you?
Why wouldn't she?
Because you have a bit of a track record. Rousseau gave a confiding smile. What you do in your spare time is none of my business. We're French, you and I, men of the world. My point is it would not be altogether troubling to us if Madame Watson were left with the impression you were with another woman tonight.
Not troubling for you, said Martel, but for me, I'm sure you'll think of something to say to her.
You always do. But back to the matter at hand, said Rousseau. It should be obvious by this point that you have been the target of a carefully planned operation. Now it's time to move to the next phase.
The next phase?
The prize, said Rousseau. You're going to help us find him. And if you don't, I'm going to make it my life's work to destroy you. And Madame Watson. After a silence, Rousseau added, Or perhaps the thought of Madame Watson suffering for your crimes doesn't bother you. Perhaps you find such sentiments old-fashioned. Perhaps you're not that sort of man. Martel returned Rousseau's gaze calmly. But when his eyes settled once more on Gabriel, his confidence appeared to waver. In any case, Rousseau was saying, now might be a good time to listen to the rest of René Devereux's interrogation. Not the entire thing. That would take too long. Just the relevant portion. He glanced at Mikhail, who tapped a key on a laptop computer. Instantly the room swelled with the sound of two men speaking in French, one with a distinct Corsican accent, the other as though he were in physical pain.
Where do the drugs come from?
We get them from all over. Turkey, Lebanon, Afghanistan, everywhere. And the hash. The hash comes from Morocco.
Who's your supplier?
We used to have several. Now... We work with one man. He's the largest producer in the country.
His name?
Mohammed.
Mohammed what?
Bakar.
Mikhail paused the recording. Rousseau looked at Jean-Luc Martel and smiled.
Why don't we start there, he said, with Mohammed Bakar.
Chapter 39 Côte d'Azur, France. There are many reasons why an individual might agree to work on behalf of an intelligence service, few of them admirable. Some do it out of avarice, some for love or political conviction, and some do it because they are bored or disgruntled or vengeful at having been passed over for promotion while colleagues, whom they invariably regard as inferior, are pushed up the ladder of success. With a bit of flattery and a pot of money, these contemptible souls can be convinced to betray the secrets that pass between their fingertips or through the computer networks they are hired to maintain. Professional intelligence officers are more than happy to take advantage of such men, but secretly they despise them, almost as much as the man who betrays his country for reasons of conscience. These are the useful idiots of the trade,
For the professional, there is no lower form of life. Nor does the professional trust those who volunteer their services, for oftentimes it is difficult to assess their true motives. Instead, he prefers to identify a potential recruit and then make the first move. Usually he comes bearing gifts, but occasionally he finds it necessary to employ less savory methods. Consequently, the professional is always on the lookout for failings and weakness. An extramarital affair, a predilection for pornography, a financial indiscretion. These are the master keys of the trade. They unlock any door. Moreover, coercion is a great clarifier of intentions. It illuminates the dark corners of the human heart. The man who spies because he has no other choice is less of a mystery than one who walks into an embassy with a briefcase full of stolen documents. Still, the coerced asset can never be fully trusted. Inevitably, he will attempt to find some way to repay the injustice visited upon him, and he can be controlled only so long as his original sin remains a threat to him. Therefore, asset and handler invariably find themselves entangled in a love affair of the damned. It was into this category of asset that Jean-Luc Martel, hotelier, restaurateur, clothier, jeweler, and international dealer of illicit narcotics, fell. He had not volunteered his services, nor had he been lured to the table through the power of persuasion. He had been identified, assessed, and targeted with an elaborate and costly operation. His relationship with Olivia Watson had been torn asunder. His business associate had been beaten mercilessly with a hammer. He had been threatened with prison and ruin. Nevertheless, a recruitment still had to be made. Coercion could open a door, but to close a deal required skill and seduction. An accommodation would have to be reached. It was unavoidable. They needed Jean-Luc Martel much more than he needed them. Drug dealers were a dime a dozen, but Saladin was one of a kind. He did not go easily to his fate, but this was to be expected. A man who kills both his father and his mentor is not a man who frightens easily. He evaded, he counterattacked, he made threats of his own. Rousseau, however, did not rise to Martel's bait. He was the perfect foil, unthreatening in appearance, slow to anger, patient to a fault. Martel tested Rousseau's forbearance often, such as when he demanded written assurances beneath an official Interior Ministry letterhead, granting him immunity from persecution. Now and forever, amen. Such clemency was not Rousseau's to bestow, for he was operating without ministry mandate or even the knowledge of his masters at the DGSI. And so he smiled in the face of Martel's intransigence and, with a nod in Mikhail's direction, played a moment or two of René Devereux's seaborne interrogation.
"He's lying," snapped Martel when the audio went silent. "It's a complete fantasy."
It was at this point, Gabriel would later recall, and the hidden cameras confirmed it was so, that the wind went out of Martel's sails. He settled next to Mikhail, a curious choice, and stared at the face of Natalie, who stared at the floor. A long silence ensued, long enough so that Rousseau saw fit to replay the relevant portion of the recording, the portion regarding a certain Mohamed Bachar, one of Morocco's largest producers of hashish, by some accounts the largest, a man who liked to call himself the king of the Rif Mountains, the region of the country where hashish is grown and processed for export to Europe and beyond. The man who, according to René Devereux, was Martel's one and only supplier.
"I take it," said Rousseau quietly, "you've heard the name."
And Martel, with the smallest of nods, confirmed that he had. Then the eyes moved from Natalie to Keller, who was standing protectively behind her. Keller had deceived him. Keller had betrayed him. And yet, at that moment, it seemed that Jean-Luc Martel regarded Keller as his one and only friend in the room.
"Why don't you give us a bit of background?" suggested Rousseau. "We're amateurs, after all, at least when it comes to the business of narcotics. Help us understand how it all works. Enlighten us as to the wicked ways of your world."
Rousseau's request was not as innocent as it sounded. René Devereux had already given Keller chapter and verse on Mohamed Bakar's links to the network,
but Rousseau wanted to get Martel talking, which would allow them to test the veracity of his words. A certain amount of deception was to be expected. Rousseau would demand absolute truth only where it mattered.
"Tell us a little about this man, Mohammed Bakar," he was saying. "Is he short or tall? Is he thin or is he fat like me? Does he have any hair or is he bald? Does he have one wife or two? Does he smoke? Does he drink? Is he religious?"
"He's short," answered Martel after a moment.
"And no, he doesn't drink. Mohammed is religious. Very religious, in fact."
"Do you find that surprising?"
asked Rousseau quickly, seizing on the fact that Martel had at last answered a question. "That a hashish producer is a religious man?"
"I didn't say Mohammed Bakar is a hash producer. His business is oranges."
"Oranges?"
"Yes, oranges. So no, I'm not surprised. He's a religious man. Oranges are a way of life in the Rif. The king has been trying for years to encourage the growers to plant other crops, but oranges are more lucrative than soybeans and radishes. Much more,"
Martel added with a smile.
"Perhaps the king should try harder."
"If you ask me, the king prefers things the way they are."
"How so?"
"Because oranges bring several $1 billion a year into the country. They help to keep the peace."
Lowering his voice, Martel added,
"Mohammed Bakar is not the only religious man in Morocco."
"There are many extremists in Morocco?"
"You would know better than me," said Martel.
"ISIS has many cells in Morocco?"
"So I'm told. But the king doesn't like to talk about that," he added. "ISIS is bad for tourism."
"You have a business in Morocco, do you not? A hotel in Marrakesh, if I'm not mistaken."
"Two," boasted Martel.
"How's business?"
"Down."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
"We'll get by."
"I'm sure you will."
"And to what do you attribute this drop in business?"
asked Rousseau.
"Is it ISIS?"
"The attacks on the hotels in Tunisia had a big impact on our bookings. People are afraid Morocco is next."
"Is it safe for tourists there?"
"It's safe," said Martel, "until it isn't."
Rousseau permitted himself a smile at the astuteness of the observation. Then he pointed out that Martel's business interests allowed him to enter and leave Morocco, a notorious drug-producing country, without raising suspicion. Martel, with a shrug, did not dispute Rousseau's conclusion.
"Do you entertain Mohammed Bakar at your hotel in Marrakesh?"
"Never."
"Why not?"
"He dislikes Marrakesh. Or what's become of Marrakesh, I should say."
"Too many foreigners?"
"And gays," said Martel.
"He dislikes homosexuals because of his religious beliefs?"
"I suppose."
"Where do you generally meet with him?"
"In casa,"
said Martel, using the local shorthand for Casablanca.
"Or in Fez. He has a riad in the heart of the Medina. He also owns several villas in the Rif and the Middle Atlas."
"He moves around a lot? Oranges are a dangerous business."
Again Rousseau smiled. Even he was not immune to Martel's immense charm.
"And when you meet with Monsieur Bakar, what do you discuss?"
"Brexit, the new American president, the prospects for peace in the Middle East, the usual."
"Obviously," said Rousseau, "you're joking."
"No,"
answered Martel candidly.
"Mohammed is quite intelligent, and he's interested in the world beyond the Rif."
"How would you describe his politics?"
"He's not an admirer of the West. He harbors a particular resentment toward France and America. As a rule, I try not to utter the word Israel in his presence."
"It angers him?"
"That's one way of putting it."
"And yet you do business with such a man."
"His oranges," said Martel, "are very fine."
"And when you're done talking about the state of the world?"
"What then?"
"Prices. Production schedule, delivery dates, that sort of thing."
"Prices fluctuate?"
"Supply and demand," explained Martel.
"A few years ago," Rousseau went on, "we noticed a distinct change in the way oranges were moving out of North Africa. Instead of coming across the Mediterranean, one or two at a time, aboard small vessels, it was tons of oranges in large cargo ships, all of which departed from ports in Libya.
Was there a sudden glut on the market? Or is there some other reason to explain the shift in strategy?
The latter, said Martel.
And that was?
Mohammed decided to take on a partner.
An individual?
Yes.
I suppose he would have to be a man, because someone like Mohammed Bakar would never deal with a woman.
Martel nodded.
He wanted to take a more aggressive market posture?
Much more aggressive.
Why?
Because he wanted to maximize profits quickly.
You met him?
Twice.
His name?
Khalil.
Khalil what?
That's all. Just Khalil.
He was a Moroccan?
No, he was definitely not a Moroccan.
Where was he from?
He never said.
And if you were to hazard a guess?
Jean-Luc Martel shrugged.
I'd say he was an Iraqi.
Chapter 40. Côte d'Azur, France. It was clear to everyone in the room, and once again the hidden cameras confirmed it was so, that Jean-Luc Martel did not understand the significance of the words he had just spoken. I'd say he was an Iraqi. An Iraqi who called himself Khalil. No family name, no patronymic or name of an ancestral village, only Khalil. Khalil, who had found a partner in Mohammed Bakar, a hashish grower of deep Islamic faith, who hated America and the West, and would fly into a rage at the mere mention of Israel. Khalil, who wanted to maximize profits by forcing more product onto the European market. Gabriel, the silent observer of the drama he had conceived and produced, cautioned himself not to leap to a premature conclusion. It was possible the man who called himself Khalil was not the man they were looking for, that he was merely an ordinary criminal with no interests other than making money, that he was a wild goose chase that would waste precious time and resources. Still, even Gabriel found it difficult to control the banging of his heart. He had tugged at the loose thread and connected the dots, and the trail had led him here, to the former home of a vanquished foe. The other members of his team, however, seemed entirely indifferent to Martel's revelation. Natalie, Mikhail, and Christopher Keller were each peering into some private space, and Paul Rousseau had taken that moment to load his first pipe. A moment later, his lighter flared, and a cloud of smoke rolled over the two Venetian canal scenes by Guardi. Gabriel, the restorer, winced involuntarily. If Rousseau were even remotely intrigued by the Iraqi who called himself Khalil, he gave no outward sign of it. Khalil was an afterthought. Khalil was of no importance. Rousseau was more interested, or so it seemed, in the nuts and bolts of Martel's relationship with Mohammed Bakar. Who ran the show? That was what he wanted to know. Who held the upper hand? Was it Martel the distributor, or Bakar the Moroccan grower?
You don't know much about business, do you?
I'm an academic, apologized Rousseau.
It's a negotiation, explained Martel, but ultimately the producer holds the upper hand.
Because he can cut out the distributor at any time?
Correct.
Couldn't you find another source of drugs?
Oranges, said Martel.
Ah, yes, oranges, agreed Rousseau.
It's not so easy.
Because of the quality of Mohammed Bakar's oranges?
Because Mohammed Bakar is a man of considerable power and influence. He would discourage other producers from selling to you?
Strongly.
And when Mohammed Bakar told you he wanted to sharply increase the amount of oranges he was sending to Europe, I advised against it.
Why?
Any number of reasons.
Such as?
Large shipments are inherently dangerous.
Because they're easier for the authorities to find?
Obviously.
What else?
I was concerned we would saturate the market,
and thus drive down the price of oranges in Western Europe.
Supply and demand, said Martel again with a shrug.
And when you raised these concerns?
He gave me a very simple choice.
Take it or leave it?
In so many words.
And you took it, said Rousseau.
Martel was silent. Rousseau tacked abruptly.
Shipping, he said. Who's responsible for the shipping?
Mohammed. He puts the package in the mail, and we pick it up at the other end.
I assume he tells you when to expect the package.
Of course.
What are his preferred methods?
In the old days he used small boats to bring the merchandise directly across the Mediterranean from Morocco to Spain. Then the Spaniards tightened things up on the coast, so he started moving it across North Africa to the Balkans. It was a long and costly journey. A lot of oranges went missing along the way, especially when they reached Lebanon and the Balkans.
They were stolen by local criminal gangs?
The Serbian and Bulgarian mafia are quite fond of citrus products, said Martel. Mohammed spent years trying to devise a way to get his oranges to Europe without having to go through their territory. And then a solution fell into his lap.
The solution, said Rousseau, was Libya.
Martel nodded slowly.
It was a dream come true, made possible by the President of France and his friends in Washington and London, who declared that Gaddafi had to go. Once the regime crumbled, Libya was open for business. It was the Wild West. No central government, no police, no authority of any kind except for the militias and the Islamic psychos. But there was a problem.
What's that?
The militias and the Islamic psychos, said Martel.
They disapproved of oranges?
No. They wanted a cut.
Otherwise they wouldn't let the oranges reach the Libyan ports. Mohammed needed a local partner, someone who could keep the militias and the holy warriors in line. Someone who could guarantee that the oranges would find their way into the bellies of the cargo ships.
Someone like Khalil? Asked Rousseau.
Martel made no reply.
Do you remember a ship called the Apollo? Asked Rousseau.
The Italians seized it off Sicily with 17 metric tons of oranges in its holds.
The name, said Martel archly, rings a bell. I assume it was your cargo.
Martel, with his expressionless gaze, confirmed that it was.
Were there other ships before the Apollo that weren't intercepted?
Several.
And remind me, said Rousseau, feigning bewilderment, who bears the expense of a seizure? The producer or the distributor?
I can't sell the oranges if I don't receive them.
So you're saying, and please forgive me, Monsieur Martel, I don't mean to belabor the point, that Mohammed Bakar personally lost millions of euros when the Apollo was seized?
That's correct.
He must have been furious.
Beyond, said Martel. He summoned me to Morocco and accused me of leaking the information to the Italians.
Why would you do such a thing?
Because I was opposed to the large shipments in the first place, and the best way to make them stop would be to lose a ship or two.
Were you responsible for the tip that led the Italians to the Apollo?
Of course not. I told Mohammed in no uncertain terms that the problem was at his end.
By that, said Rousseau, you mean North Africa.
Libya, said Martel.
And when the seizures continued,
Khalil plugged the leaks,
and the oranges started to arrive safely again.
And there it was again, the name of Mohammed Bakar's aggressive new partner, the man whom Paul Rousseau had been avoiding. After a prolonged pause to load and light another pipe, he wondered when it was that Jean-Luc Martel had first met this Iraqi who called himself Khalil. No family name, no patronymic or ancestral village, only Khalil. Martel said it had been in 2012. The spring, he reckoned. Late March, perhaps, but he couldn't say for certain. Rousseau, however, would have none of it. Martel was the lord of a vast criminal enterprise, the details of which he carried around with him in his head. Surely, insisted Rousseau, he could recall the date of such a memorable meeting.
It was the 29th of March.
And the circumstances? Were you summoned, or was it previously scheduled?
Martel indicated that his presence had been requested.
And how is that done, generally? It's a small point, I know, but I'm curious.
A message is left for me at my hotel in Marrakesh.
A voice message?
Yes.
And the first meeting where Khalil was present?
It was in Gaza. I flew there on my plane and checked into a hotel. A few hours later they told me where to go.
Mohammed called you personally?
One of his men. Mohammed doesn't like to use the phone for business.
And the hotel. Which one was it, please?
The Sofitel. And did you go alone?
Olivia came with me.
Rousseau frowned thoughtfully.
Do you always bring her?
Whenever possible.
Why?
Appearances matter.
Did she come to the meeting?
No.
She stayed at the hotel while I went over to Anfa.
Anfa?
It was a wealthy enclave on a hill west of downtown, explained Martel, a place of palm-lined avenues and walled villas where the price per square meter rivaled London and Paris. Mohammed Bakar owned a property there. As usual, Martel had to submit to a search before being allowed to enter. It was, he recalled now, more invasive than normal. Inside, he had expected to find Bakar alone, as was customary for their meetings. Instead, another man was present.
Describe him, please.
Tall, broad shoulders, big face and hands.
His skin?
Dark, but not too.
How was he dressed?
Western, dark suit, white shirt, no tie.
Scars or distinguishing features?
No.
Tattoos?
I could only see his hands.
And?
Martel shook his head.
Were you introduced?
Barely.
Did he speak?
Not to me, only to Mohammed.
In Arabic, I presume.
Yes.
Mohammed Bakar speaks Maghrebi Arabic.
Darija, said Martel.
And the other man? Was he a Darija speaker too?
Martel shook his head.
You can tell the difference? I learned to speak a bit of Arabic when I was a child. I got it from my mother, he added. So yes, I can tell the difference. He spoke like someone from Iraq.
And you didn't wonder about this man's affiliation, given the fact that ISIS had taken over much of Iraq and Syria and established a base of operations in Libya? Or perhaps you didn't want to know, added Rousseau contemptuously.
Perhaps it's better not to ask too many questions in a situation like that.
As a general rule, said Martel, they can be bad for business.
Especially when the likes of ISIS are involved.
Rousseau checked his anger.
And the second meeting, when was that?
Last December.
After the attacks on Washington?
Definitely.
The exact date, please?
I believe it was the 19th.
And the circumstances?
It was our annual winter meeting.
Where did it take place?
Mohammed kept changing the location. We finally met in a little village up in the Rif.
What was on the agenda?
Prices and approximate shipping dates for the new year. Mohammed and the Iraqi wanted to push even more product onto the market, lots of product, and quickly.
How was he dressed this time?
Like a Moroccan.
Meaning?
He was wearing a djellaba.
A traditional Moroccan robe with a hood.
Martel nodded.
And his face was thinner and sharper.
He'd lost weight?
Plastic surgery.
Was there anything else different about him?
Yes, said Martel. He walked with a limp.
Chapter 41. Côte d'Azur, France. There was a part of Paul Rousseau that had no stomach for the deal that would have to be made. Jean-Luc Martel, he would say later, was proof positive France had erred in doing away with the guillotine. But Khalil the Iraqi, Khalil whose face had been altered, Khalil who walked with a limp, was well worth the price. Coercion alone would not be sufficient to drag Martel across the finish line. He would have to be transformed into a full-fledged asset of the Alpha Group. An operative of French intelligence, so help me God, lamented Rousseau. And only a promise of full immunity from prosecution would be sufficient to secure his unwavering cooperation. Rousseau had no power to make such a promise. Only his minister could. Which presented Rousseau with yet another dilemma, for his minister still knew nothing of the operation. He was a man who famously did not like surprises. Perhaps in this case he would find it in his heart to make an exception. For now, Rousseau held his nose and put Martel through his paces. They went over it all again, slowly, meticulously, forward, backward, sideways, and every other way that Rousseau, who was looking for any inconsistency, any reason to question the authenticity of his source, could imagine.
Particular attention was paid to the agenda of the winter meeting where Khalil the Iraqi had been present, especially the schedule for upcoming deliveries. 3 large shipments were due in the next 10 days. All would be concealed inside cargo ships bound from Libya. 2 would be arriving at French ports, Marseille and nearby Toulon, but the 3rd would dock in the Italian port of Genoa.